Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered here and there across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. Once again, this is the navigator of the GNE, John Lash, and I'm recording on in the early hours of Thursday, January 24th, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 40, and the title is Trinity of Evil. Now, that's a pretty heavy title, Trinity of Evil. And you might suspect that I'm going to take you into some pretty heavy material, and that could be in the course of this briefing. I'd like to say, to start, that what you are due to hear now is superior to anything that you have ever heard about evil. Does that sound like I'm bragging? Well, perhaps it sounds extremely arrogant. But I'm simply making a statement of fact. You can decide for yourself whether this statement, this claim, if you will, this presumption, is correct or not. As I proceed, though, with this heavy subject, please note my style and see if I tend to get heavy-handed about it. I like to follow my own advice on those rare occasions when I do give any advice, and I'm doing it right now. In the course of forming strategies for the magical war against the adversary, against the authorities and the adversary, it's inevitable that from time to time there will be some really heavy, even gruesomely heavy material to consider. In doing so, though, I ask you to stay light with it and keep a light hand on your weapons, like a samurai keeps a light hand on his sword. He doesn't grip it with white knuckles as it sits on his hip, stationed in its scabbard, nor does he pull it out and wave it around and scream and holler in some kind of dramatic fashion. And the samurai is very light and slight and subtle with his sword. This is how we must be as well with these tools of knowledge, magic, beauty, and energy that compile or comprise the weapons of Gaian psychotronics and echo sorcery. So, with that little comment, where do I begin to describe the Trinity of Evil in a way that no one else on this planet has ever done so far? Well, I would say an excellent place to start is to recapitulate and rephrase the view of evil held by the Gnostics, so-called, that is to say, the Telestai, or illuminated teachers of the mystery schools, illumined teachers, if you will, to distinguish syntactically the word illumined from the word illuminati. The word illuminati is a dirty word. It's, in many respects, a helpful word in regard to the analysis of certain historical events that have occurred behind the scenes over the past 350 years or so. But it is not a helpful event, or excuse me, a helpful term, referring back to events previous to that time. The Telestai, who founded and directed the mystery schools of pre-Christian antiquity, were not Illuminati, nor were they the forebears and precursors of the Illuminati, but they were illumined people. They were phosters, to use the Coptic Greek term, light bearers. How did these illumined men and women regard evil, and how did they define evil? Well, unfortunately, the word for evil in the Nag Hammadi writings, which are Coptic writings based on Greek, uses the Greek word kaka for evil. That's right, the word kaka. And that is, in fact, the term for evil, or the primary term for evil, found in the surviving Gnostic writings. So we can't get very far with kaka. And obviously, as I've said, there are extreme problems with the language and syntax of Coptic when it comes to conveying the scope and power of telestic illumination. But I am convinced that my rendering of the Gnostic view of evil is correct, and I am convinced as well that if you go back and check it against the text, you will find that it stands up well against the surviving materials. Let me give you a quick paraphrase of how the Gnostikoi regarded evil. They regarded it as the result of ignorance. Ignorance is the mother of evil. That is a direct quote from one of the NHC texts, Gospel of Philip, I believe. Anyway, you can look it up. You can find it in my commentaries on the Nag Hammadi writings on metahistory.org. So evil is behavior that occurs due to ignorance, and it is a kind of behavior that thrives where there is ignorance, deceit, and secrecy. So evil, in Gnostic terms, is totally and entirely a form of human behavior, or an expression of human will, if you will. Now, I know that many of you have pondered this question of evil at length, and you may have an objection here. You may say, hey, hold on, wait a minute here, John. Do you mean by saying that ignorance is the mother of evil, that those who do evil are not aware that they do it, that they are ignorant, that they are doing evil? Well, to a certain extent, there is a truth in that. You know, there are a lot of human animals on this planet who don't intend to do evil, but they commit evil acts, or they commit acts that support the perpetration of evil due to their ignorance, due to their naivete and their denial. I emphasize to you that naivete and denial, which are absolutely obvious generic traits of the human animal, are extremely serious flaws, if you will. They are extremely high, they are high risk handicaps of the anthropos. And through naivete and denial, even good and well-meaning people can be accessory to evil or can actually do evil. On the other hand, there are some people who perpetrate evil acts openly, flagrantly, intentionally, and in full conscience, knowing exactly what they do. So then how could I say, well, are they an exception, are those human animals, as perpetrators of evil, an exception in that they cannot be, we cannot consider them to be ignorant or oblivious of what they are doing? That is true. Someone who performs evil deeds consciously and deliberately is not acting out of ignorance of what they do, but they are acting out of ignorance of what makes them do it. So the rule applies to both cases. The hardcore cases of evil perpetrators or the hardcore cases of perpetrators of evil who do it deliberately, and what we may call the massive group of soft-core perpetrators of evil who do it inadvertently and who thereby add to the power and the cumulative effect of those hardcore perpetrators. Clear enough? Now, my syntax for evil at this point, if that might be helpful, runs like this. Evil is an activity or a thought committed by a human being. There are evil thoughts as well as evil deeds. Committed by a human being that operates against the symbiosis of life and impedes the thriving of life to its highest potential of beauty, play, and creativity, including innovation and discovery. That is evil. Evil is whatever contributes to the suppression of the divine endowment of the anthropos, the gifts endowed in us, in our species, as well as in all other living species, and the beauty and intelligence of the processes of nature. All of these aspects of the material and immanent dreaming of the wisdom goddess stand as an open miracle to her presence. And whatever opposes that miracle and works against the symbiotic weave of life and the innate desire of all things to thrive by demonstrating their place in the magnificent pattern of her beauty. All of that operating against her beauty is evil. That is what you might consider to be a generic and overarching definition of evil. Of course, I can be more specific. Evil is very obviously the act of one human being upon another that harms the other human being, or that harms, that needlessly harms other creatures. You can harm someone and it wouldn't be an act of evil if, for instance, you were trying to disarm someone with a knife who attacked you on the street and you ended up having to use the knife on them. That would not be an act of evil. So there is no categorical definition of evil except when it comes to rape and the molestation of children. Murder is, in some instances, justifiable in self-defense. This is even accepted in the charade of law, as it's called. But there is no occasion, ever, at any time on this planet, when rape and the molestation of children can be considered not evil. That is, if anything is an absolute evil, that is it. Rape is a more serious crime than murder. The molestation of children is a more serious crime than murder. And so those are the two exceptions in this general profile of evil that I'm offering. You might add a third exception, which was understood in antiquity, and that is that the desecration of the natural world, that is to say, pollution of the natural world, or undue imposition of human will upon the natural world, may also be unequivocally considered as evil. And as a crime, as serious as murder. But apart from that, evil is harm done against the web of life in the general sense. And that is to say, apart from those particular instances. Now, the harming of life and the crimes against life perpetrated in acts of evil can be perpetrated in a number of ways. They primarily in three ways. They can be perpetrated by individuals. Is that passive voice? Okay. The first way is that unique individuals can perpetrate acts of evil. The second way is that groups of people joined together collectively can perpetrate acts of evil. And the third way is by proxy, that an individual or group of individuals can perpetrate acts of evil using other human beings by proxy. Those are primarily the three forms that you find in the world today, and they can be relatively easily identified. Now, somewhere along the way, not too many years ago, I think it was when I started to write under the theme of open season on predators in Right Action, the Right Action section of metahistory.org, I introduced the term orchestrations of social evil. I use this term to apply to the second and third categories just described. If there is one individual who perpetrates evil, then that is someone who is not necessarily evil as an individual, but whose behavior is evil. We're talking about behavior here. But if there are collectives perpetrating evil, either directly or by proxy, that type of behavior falls under the category that I have defined as orchestrations of social evil. Now, right now on this planet, things are not going so well in certain respects in the larger picture. Society as a whole and the planetary community of nations as a whole is experiencing a rather difficult time. And the epoch that we live in is marked, passive voice, due to historical events that have unfolded over the last 350 or 400 years, the effects of human beings operating secretly has impacted our world with massive orchestrations of social evil. Currently, we face massive orchestrations of social evil on this planet. That is to say, evil perpetrated by a collective based on a certain agenda, and evil perpetrated by proxy, also based on a certain agenda. For instance, the imperialism and military expansion of the American military-industrial complex is an example or exemplifies an orchestration of social evil executed by proxy, what is actually to a very large extent a Zionist faction of the planet, a Zionist slash Israeli mafia faction, who are using the American military to execute for them a war by proxy. One of the characteristics of the problem of Jewmanity is that the Jewmans, who operate from the Talmudic agenda of Judaism, never fight their own battles, and they would never be caught in a fair fight. They would never enter any kind of fight that isn't already rigged from the beginning. So the people that fall into that category of perpetrator, the Juman slash Zionist Israeli mafia types, are the most despicable cowards that have ever walked among the herd of human animals. They cannot fight directly. They cannot face any adversary who would be equal to them in strength. And they use others to fight their wars by proxy. This being the example, sadly, tragically, of what has happened to the American military for many decades now, but specifically since 9/11. The forces of the American military, including the lives of many young American men and women, are now conducting a proxy war for an alien party, for an enemy of the United States who disguises itself as a friend in a very Mephistophelian manner of deceit. Okay? I don't want to talk too much about those kind of particulars in this briefing, but that's just one example of how the concepts, the profiling I'm doing, might be useful to you as you look at current events. Due to the ongoing and undetected and undeterred effects of certain human groups, certain groups of human animals operating in secrecy and operating according to a secret agenda over the last 350 or 400 years. Go back to the defenestration of Prague, 1620. You don't have to go back any further than that. That was also the time of the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos. You don't have to go back any further than that. Come forward from, say, 1620. Come forward to the French Revolution, and then move on and up through the 19th century to the Russian Revolution. These events reveal the operations of secret cabals or power elites who are perpetrating hideous, murderous acts of evil upon the planet and upon the human race. And the leaders of those cabals are self-declared enemies of humanity. So in addition to Mephisto, by the way, who is not the enemy, note that I did not say Mephisto is the enemy. I called Mephisto the adversary. Mephisto the adversary. I advise you to hold that term in your syntax. The enemies that surround Mephisto, the enemies that operate in the camp of Mephisto, are human. They're human beings who belong to cabals and power elites operating on this planet. And anyone who looks into this matter can learn many things, but there is one thing you must absolutely learn, and one thing you must absolutely know beyond all doubt, and that is that the human enemies in these secret power elites follow an agenda that contains a declaration of war against all of humanity that does not belong to a particular ethnic strain. And all you have to do is go look into and investigate the Talmud to know what I'm talking about. Now, that does not mean that all of human animals who belong to that particular ethnic strain of humanity are party to these power elites. No. Be clear on that. The power elites use what is now called identity politics. They use that ethnic identity as a tool, an instrument of victim-perpetrator entrapment. It is one of the most skillful weapons of the enemies who surround the adversary, Mephisto. Remember the old Godfather in the Godfather films, Marlon Brando? The advice to the Godfather, Stay close to your friends and even closer to your enemies. One of the first strategies we learn here now, going into the spring of 2013, is how to be close to the enemies. That is to say, to be close to them in perception, to be close to them in detection of their presence, of their purposes, and of their procedures, their strategies and tactics. Know the enemy. Now, these enemies organized into mafia-like bands of power elites, secret societies, cabals, have produced in human society certain institutions which carry their agenda. And if you understand that picture, I can assure you that you can say, as I do, that you can state unequivocally that certain institutions on this planet are evil. They are evil because they are instruments for the perpetration of evil according to the agenda of these power elites. First and foremost, the state is evil. Period. This is an unequivocal statement. There is no way to modify the statement. There is no way to qualify the statement. The state is evil. All federal government agencies are instruments of evil, even if they have good people in them. Corporations are evil, period. There is no equivocation here. There is no qualification. There is no such thing as a corporation that is not evil. Central banking is evil. Central banking is an instrument of financial terrorism by which the perpetrators of evil devastate and ruin entire countries and deprive generations of people of the opportunity to survive and thrive and enjoy the wonderful privileges of being alive on this planet. These are the great evils: the state, corporations, and central banking. The only qualification I would add to what I just said is that it might be possible for corporations to be constructed by human collective effort, and for government agencies likewise to be established that would not contribute unilaterally to evil and could be controlled and monitored on one supreme condition. You know what that condition is? What is the one supreme condition for any social instrument, institution, or agency in order that it would not become an instrument of evil? A complete lack of secrecy. Secrecy is one of the great tools of Mephisto. And it's like the secrecy of a magician, you know, of a stage show magician. You know, David Copperfield, whoever these people are, he was a big magician years ago. I don't know who the current ones are, but they couldn't perform their act on stage if they didn't keep secret how they do it. Likewise, the orchestrations of social evil operating through corporations and federal agencies all around the world, governmental agencies, would not succeed for a minute without holding these operations in secrecy. So a total lack of secrecy and a total transparency is the only possible condition that would allow for these types of institutions to be beneficial to society. These institutions have to be regarded with the greatest suspicion and with the severity of the Matangi eye, because these institutions are tools for orchestration of social evil on a scale that threatens the life of every single person on this planet. And I don't think that I am overstating the case here. On the contrary, I think that I am stating the obvious. Now, it's also obvious, I'm sure you would agree, that I could go on for hours in this vein. I could talk about historical events, people. I could talk about the development of these orchestrations of evil. For instance, as that occurred in the rise of the Russian Revolution. And so forth and so on. And then you could add those words of mine, those recorded words, to the huge stockpile that exists in the alternative media. And that would be more blather and more talk and more commentary about evil, but it would be all talk and no action. But speaking to you as a Calico warrior, I am committed to talk for action and to talk to action. And I am committed that everything that I would say in profiling evil would be actional or actionable. So, as a Kalika, I must look for the most effective syntax that will lead directly to engagement with the enemy and will lead to an efficient defense and an efficient offense regarding the enemy and the adversary. In that spirit, I offer you my paradigm of the Trinity of Evil. Trinity of Evil consists of three entities. If you can see these entities and picture them standing on the battle line opposed to the three warrior goddesses, Kali, Matangi, and Kurukula, then you can see the situation of engagement. You can see what is happening on the battlefront of this planet. I repeat, it is a magical battle for the Anthropos, all living creatures, and the Wisdom Goddess itself. Kalikas and those in planetary tantra who support the Kalikas accept to be engaged in a magical war against the authorities. Now, I use that term authorities, and as you know, that refers to the Archons. So can it be said that the Archons are part of the Trinity of Evil? Well, they most certainly are. I would even say, for the purposes of this profile, of this strategic briefing, that you can consider the Lord Archon, or Demiurge, Yaldabaoth, to be one of the three entities in the Trinity of Evil. That would be the archontic participant, the archontic member of the Trinity. That is to say, a non-human, an extraterrestrial cyborg. Yaldabaoth operates from the depths of the outer space of the solar system beyond the Earth. The word Yaldabaoth appears to be a strange amalgam involving some kind of Aramaic pun. And it may mean the one, the childlike one, who ranges across space. Strange definition, but as you know, there is an allusion here to the neonate form of the Archons, the gray ETs, These are the childlike ones who range across space. And the lord of that horde, the overlord of that horde of neonate cyborgs, is called Eldabaoth, one member. The other member of the Trinity of Evil is, of course, Mephisto himself. So there you go. Not doing so bad here. 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Let me make absolutely certain that your minds are crystal clear on the nature of these entities. Yaldabaoth is not a product of human imagination. Yaldabaoth is a cosmic freak, an anomaly, an accident produced by the impact of the ionic currents of the divine Sophia upon the Dima, the dense elementary matter arrays that float in the galactic arms in a kind of quantum foam, if you want to call it that. Soot, really. And keep Eldabaoth in that category. Non-human, extraterrestrial, not a product of our imagination, but existing, actually, having a material form, silicon-based life form, and being of an androgyne nature with shape-shifting capacities, hence the reptilian shape-shifting motif. The Gnostics clearly recognized Yaldabaoth as a shape-shifting reptilian. They did not, however, claim that shape-shifting reptilians can take human form. I must point out at this juncture that it is an extremely reckless and stupid error on the part of certain people investigating these matters to claim that the Archons can, these shape-shifting reptilians can assume human form and that they walk among us in the personage of certain well-known people of the power elite. What's wrong with that claim? First of all, it's completely unsubstantiated except by personal testimony, which of course is totally subjective and could be delusional. There is no material evidence of this, to my knowledge. No reliable material evidence, so there could be faked evidence of it. But let me say loud and clear, what is the problem with making that claim? It's a huge problem for humanity because it plays directly into the hands of the trickster, Mephisto. Because one of the techniques of Mephisto is this: to use what humans anticipate in order to achieve his own agenda before he actually achieves it. This Mephisto technique can be seen operating in the world today. You can see it operating in the world today in a number of places. Let me just point out one to you. There are certain alarmists in the American scene, certain alarmists on the internet who make claims about what is happening with the militarization of the police force in the United States. Now, it goes without saying that the militarization of the police in the United States is a fact. It is an ongoing fact. But were I to describe that to you, and were I to say that the militarized police in the United States have more power than they actually do have, were I, in fact, to exaggerate that, I would then be playing into Mephistopheles' game. Because I would be talking about something that may come to be as if it already is. And you'll find that there is one particular alarmist who uses this technique constantly. That is not to say that he is a conscious agent of Mephisto, but he is using the Mephisto tongue. He is using the Mephisto tactic, namely, to claim that something is so before it is actually so, so that it can become so. That is the Mephisto tactic. And so, it is obviously a dangerous tactic because it throws off the orientation, the rigorous warrior-like vigilance and orientation that we require to engage the enemy and to engage the adversary himself. It throws it off. It skews our approach to the enemy. To claim that the enemy has more power than they actually have, because in making that claim, you give them the advantage to fulfill it. That is an entrapment in a Mephisto technique. And there are people out there who are broadly and widely known and massively followed who exemplify the entrapment in this Mephisto technique, unfortunately, for them and everybody who believes them. I can offer you another example to illustrate the danger of this Mephisto technique, or more specifically, of falling for this Mephisto technique. Some people, commenting on the problem of evil in the world today, claim that there are cults of Satanists on the planet who are perpetrating magical rituals. They claim that these blood Satan-worshipping, blood-drinking monsters are part of the power elite and part of and key members of the secret cabals who are directing these orchestrations for their purposes and according to their agenda. I, on the other hand, would say to you that such actual, literal cults of Satan worship do not yet exist, but they may well come into existence due to the claim that they are already in existence. It is an error to claim that they are already in existence, but it is certainly necessary to realize that they could come into existence in the near future. If you can wrap your head around that syntax, you can understand how reckless and dangerous it is to claim that something already exists when in fact it is only a potential, in an emergent potential. By making such claims, the person who makes them contributes to the fulfillment of that potential. This is another technique of entrapment and deceit originating from the adversary. The tricks of the adversary are of this type. They operate in our own minds, and then human beings, being the animals we are, who love to communicate and share what we know, actually end up spreading and propagating the technique by way of belief systems and claims. In that manner, these techniques come to infect and to contaminate the entire field of the collective mind of humanity. Now, having developed my profile of the Trinity of Evil to this point, let's proceed to the third agent in this Trinity. Before I disclose this agent, I want to ask you to consider something. I want to ask you to consider making a commitment to the future of this planet and to all beings, human, animals, and others who inhabit it. How would you demonstrate that you have made this commitment? Well, it's not a commitment to me, obviously not, but it's a commitment to be realized in a way through me or through your connection with me. So I ask you to consider that if you accept the complete picture of the trinity of evil I'm now presenting, that you will concentrate entirely on this picture and not be distracted by anything that does not fit this picture. This picture of the trinity of evil is like a set of sights I am giving you. Your mind is a weapon. The beauty of your intelligence is a weapon. And I offer you the sights to mount on that weapon. It is a triangular sight. And through this sight, you can see the enemy. You can see the adversary. And you can see the duplicity of the ultimate face of evil. And you don't need anything else or any other speculations or any other claims. So I ask you to consider how much you can actually concentrate on what I'm saying. And beyond that, how to concentrate what I'm saying into the perception of what is in front of you in this world. Concentrate on the spot at the center of this triangular sight that lies equidistant between the three points of Yaldabaoth, Mephisto, and Melchizedek. Now this name Melchizedek may ring a bell for some of you. It may ring a whole set of screaming alarms. Did you know that Melchizedek is the guardian angel of the state of Israel? Melchizedek is, of course, a subject to be found in Not in His Image. Interestingly as well, I did a DVD in October, or I did some interviews in October of 2008. 10 hours of interview, actually, with Jay Widener. Jay eventually edited those interviews down into a DVD and called Sophia Returning, the Dawn of Planetary Tantra. Although Jay was accompanied by his partner Sharon at the time, urged me to tell the entire Sophianic myth so that it could be put on record. And doing so, they urged me of the importance of this, that people would want to hear the Sophia myth narrated in my voice, in my words. Although they urged me to do that, and although I did indeed recount that myth as I sat in a chair in the salon in the Schiller Hotel Schiller in Amsterdam, they did not include that material in the Sophia Returning DVD. They did not dedicate 20 or 25 minutes of the DVD to that full account which I provided to them. Instead, Jay Widener decided to use a part of an interview in which he and I discussed the subject of Melchizedek, and he asked me to talk about Melchizedek, and he made the editorial decision, because he was the director of the DVD, to include my comments about Melchizedek rather than to include the full narration of the Sophia mythos. So there you go. That was his choice. At that time, I made a statement about Melchizedek. And now again, I'm going to restate what I said. According to the Gnostic view of the Archons, their primary tool of deceit is called hal, or simulation. They are masters of simulation, or virtual reality. What then would be the ultimate triumph of the Archons? Well, first of all, they falsely claim to have created the human being. As I pointed out, Gnostics or Telestai living at the time of the Dead Sea cult had been observing the Archons already for thousands of years in their Magian schools of initiation. They were aware that what we call today the Sitchin scenario or Anunnaki scenario, which claims that humanity was created by extraterrestrials called Anunnaki, they knew that that was a lie, that that was disinformation planted in the human mind by the Archons themselves. It is the Archons' own origin myth. It is their mandate of power insinuated into the human mind. They also knew, however, that if the Archons had the chance to do so, they would produce a replication of the human form. That would be their highest achievement. That would be their supreme and paramount demonstration of hal, or simulation. Such an entity would be, in the language of Philip K. Dick, a simulacrum, a perfect simulacrum. And you'll know that Dick treated of this subject extensively in his novels. There are simulacra in the novels of Philip K. Dick. One of them is a simulacrum of Abraham Lincoln that is so lifelike that there's no way to tell that it is not the actual historical human person, Abraham Lincoln. What I stated to Jay Widener at that time, and what I state again to the world now, is that yes, it is true. The Archons did succeed in creating one perfect simulacrum of the human animal. And the name of that simulacrum is Melchizedek. They then caused that simulacrum to appear to the patriarch Abraham and to initiate through Abraham that horror which we call the Abrahamic religious belief system. Melchizedek, as I explained in Not in His Image, is the power behind Christ. Even St. Paul said that. And if you consider yourself a Christian, like as does Alex Jones and other people, then you might want to pay attention to what St. Paul said about Christ being a front man for something much more powerful. The manner in which St. Paul describes Melchizedek in Romans indicates clearly that this is an archontic clone-type entity with no generation from father or mother, that is to say, no human parentage. Okay, so they've done it. The Archons, at some undetermined point in this kalpa, managed to produce a perfect replica of the human form. Or did they? Did they really? Is it really perfect? Well, here we are on the verge of engagement of a vast magical battle. And I guess it's as good a time as any for me to tell you what's the problem with Melchizedek. The Archons have a serious problem with Melchizedek in that it is not a perfect replica of the human form in and out. It is only a replica mold of the human form. By that I mean that if Melchizedek were standing in front of you, and if you want to know what he looks like, go look at the figure of Melchizedek on Chartres Cathedral, this tall, thin, Gothic-style figure holding the Grail cup. Ha, big joke. You will, if you were in the presence of that actual simulacrum, you might be astonished, and you might indeed be unable to distinguish it from a real live human animal, as certainly is the case with those people living on this planet today who have encountered Melchizedek. However, you would be mistaken. In order to know the true nature and composition of that simulacrum called Melchizedek, you would have to take out a knife and slice it. Slice into the flesh, or the simulated apparent flesh, of Melchizedek. For instance, slice into the arm. And what you would see then would be nothing but a kind of opaque gel. Because although the archons managed to produce this perfect simulacrum, it is only a mold of the human form without the internal organs. Melchizedek has no internal organs. He has no internal composition whatsoever. But outwardly, he presents the exact and convincing appearance of a human being, with skin, with hair, with teeth, with eyes, everything that belongs to the external mold of the human form, the archons achieved in replicating. But they did not replicate the inner organs. Now, take a moment with me here to consider what flashes and surges into your mind upon hearing those preceding words. Well, some of you might find that an association rushes into your mind at this moment. There are two associations that may possibly rush into your mind. One of them is a jumbled mass of information. One of them comes in the form of a jumbled mass of information that you have heard or read about ETs operating on human beings, and about horrific tanks in underground laboratories managed by ETs, ET archons. In these tanks, for instance, some are said to exist under Dulce, New Mexico, are body parts. Body parts. These are the body parts that the archons would like to have made. They envy the human form, not only for its external composition, but even more so for the complexity of its body parts. So this horrific scenario of body parts is actually a projection in the human mind of the frenzy and desperation of the archons who would like to have had been able to manufacture those parts and install them in the interior of the Melchizedek simulacrum. But they could not do so. Think again. Where have you heard about body parts? Have you heard horror stories about body parts? Well, Israel is the one country in the entire world which conducts the most traffic in the collection and sale of human body parts, human organs. To some extent, that trafficking in body parts comes under the roof of certain institutions, you know, medical institutions, medical research. Ha, medical research by Jewish Israeli doctors. But to a great measure and to a much greater measure, and you can go verify this by research if you'd like to, the trafficking of body parts by Israel is a black market activity. So there's a huge black market in body parts on this planet, isn't there? That's a fact. Why? It's not for the betterment of the human race. It's not for the betterment of society, because it's possible to heal any organic disease by the use of natural plants. There's no need to operate on people, except for the case of working on broken bones and things like that. But when it comes to organic processes or organic diseases, they are caused by an imbalance of the natural forces and an imbalance between the human being and the natural world. And such diseases, such organic diseases, can be cured by natural means. There's no need to traffic in body parts. The trafficking in body parts is massive dementia infecting the criminal element of the human society due to the insanity of the archons bleeding into the human mind. The archons are desperate to involve us in a fantasy that convinces us that they can produce and manipulate and install human body parts. And to the extent that we human beings allow our imagination to endorse that fantasy, it becomes true. So be careful what you imagine. Now there's another association that comes to mind immediately concerning body parts. But this is a little more esoteric. You would only have this association come up in your mind if you're familiar with the Nag Hammadi text, particularly the Apocryphon of John. Now you know that I have stated that the Apocryphon of John, which is a long and complex text and exists in three versions in the Nag Hammadi materials, is the most difficult and perplexing of the Gnostic codices. The Apocryphon of John contains a long passage which appears to describe by particular name and by particular body part, down to the fingernails and the eyelashes, it appears to describe how particular named archons are responsible for manufacturing and installing these body parts. Now, do you want to know what that is? That is not a report of something that actually happened. That is not a shaman's account of observation of what the archons have actually done. That is a record of the archontic fantasy of what they would like to do. They would like to be able to create the individual body parts of the human being and to put them together and install them in the body of Melchizedek. So you see, their ultimate triumph of simulation is flawed and incomplete, and that causes them a great deal of distress. They are really upset about that. But they deal with the situation as best they can. Now, if human beings continue to expend and engage the powers of their imagination in some nightmarish scenario about ETs stealing body parts and so forth and so on, then that's great for the archons, because they can't do anything of their own power. But they can draw upon the power of human imagination to achieve their ultimate creation, artificial humanity, transhumanist icon, Melchizedek. Melchizedek is the third point in the trinity of evil. And in concluding this briefing, I am ready to say something that could be considered dangerous. I'm not going to elaborate on it. I'm not going to play games. I'm not going to be, let's say, dramatic about it. I want you to consider if what I now say is dangerous, consider to whom it is dangerous, and consider that very carefully. When you see, when you realize the interactions between the three primary agents of evil, Melchizedek, Yaldabaoth, and Mephisto, you are as intimate to the workings of evil as those who commit it. And I mean commit it on the satanic and cosmic levels of perpetration. You are as close to evil as those who perpetrate it in your perception. To know how these three interact is to be intimate with the workings of evil. The interactions is dazzlingly simple. Melchizedek is the human simulacrum created by Yaldabaoth and handled by Mephisto. Mephisto is the handler of Melchizedek, the handler. The concept of a handler is extremely important in Gaianeco sorcery and in the Kalika strategies of magical war. I have much to say about this in the near future. So the Archons create Melchizedek as a perfect replica of the human form, but not of the human organism, because they cannot replicate the individual working parts and their relation to each other. That is beyond their skill, although they wish that they could do so. Melchizedek handles the simulacrum, that is to say, brings it to those people in the world who are insane enough to take it for God incarnate or for an immortal clone who offers them a transhumanist status of immortality. That is the promise and lure of Melchizedek. But the Archons and Mephisto have a serious problem with the simulacrum. Because Melchizedek does not have any internal organs, he does not have lungs. Because he does not have lungs, he cannot breathe. He does not need to breathe, obviously. But in handling Melchizedek, Mephisto faces the necessity to bring that entity, that phantom, that archontic phantom, into the presence of human beings in close proximity to convince them that this is indeed a cloned version of the human being, superior to the human animal. Mephisto must present Melchizedek to the human witnesses in such proximity that they would see it breathing, breathing being the proof that it is alive, as the witnesses are alive. But Melchizedek does not breathe. The Archons have a very serious problem with Melchizedek. They were unable to simulate breathing. And of course, since they cannot create a replica of the human of lungs of or any interior organs, Melchizedek is incapable of breathing in a lifelike and human-like manner. This is an extremely serious problem for the Archons and Mephisto. In order to overcome this problem, and in order to make sure that Melchizedek would be an absolutely convincing, living, breathing replica, they have to resort to very extreme measures. How do they do it then? How do they get Melchizedek to breathe, or to appear to breathe? Well, Melchizedek, bear in mind, is an iconically manufactured clone that actually exists on the planet Earth materially, just like you and I exist. Melchizedek right now, as I speak, is sitting or standing somewhere, someplace on this planet. I can most assuredly tell you that this is not a figment of a demented imagination. But you can believe it or not believe it as you wish. And Melchizedek, in his physical presence on the planet, is in the atmosphere of the Earth, like the rest of us, all other human animals, but cannot breathe the atmosphere of the Earth. However, the Archons have devised a trick which causes him to breathe, or to appear to breathe. They do this through the atmosphere itself. They introduce into the atmosphere, or cause to have introduced into the atmosphere, a certain chemical emission which may be compared to amyl nitrate, or poppers. Have you ever seen anyone take poppers? I saw it once in a theater in L.A. Some people came in, and they were sitting in front of me. And at a certain moment, they broke open these capsules and sniffed these poppers, and they went into a kind of convulsion at that moment. The Archons found a way to induce the appearance of breathing in Melchizedek by causing the replica to have these kinds of convulsions, similar to the kind produced by amyl nitrate. They did that by a chemical reaction. That is to say that Melchizedek appears to breathe in a subdued, convulsive manner. Whenever he is exposed to certain chemical emission in the atmosphere. And what is that emission? I don't know exactly what to call it or how to define it chemically. But I can tell you that it is similar to formic acid, to the scent of formic acid, and that it is produced when live blood spills into the atmosphere. So when human blood is spilt on this planet, the blood comes out of its natural enclosure, its natural encapsulated form inside the skin of the human body. The blood comes out, and it flows not only onto the earth, but it flows out into the atmosphere. The blood of human animals released into the atmosphere in turn releases a chemical emission which acts like amyl nitrate and causes Melchizedek to appear to breathe. Now, is that statement dangerous? And if so, to whom is it dangerous? To the person who made it? To the people who hear it? I leave you to consider this question. Don't get too heavy-handed about it. Don't worry. I'm not in danger. Or let me say, I'm not in any more danger than I'm already in, and neither are you. We're all in absolute mortal danger all the time. Don't you know that yet? I couldn't be any more in danger if I was standing on a street corner in Iraq or in Pakfield in Pakistan waiting for the drone to come. The fact that there are no American mercenaries breaking down the door of your house, or the fact that there is no drone flying over it, doesn't mean that you're not in mortal danger along with all the other human animals who are exposed to those horrors. So wake up and smell the paupers, because that is what Melchizedek smells. And I assure you that if you see the scenario, I'm telling you now, if you dare to look at this and dare to hold this vision, you will know that the archons are in a frenzy. To see to it that as much blood as possible is shed on this earth in order to keep their simulacrum up and running. So concludes my briefing on the Trinity of Evil.